The Chautauqua Lecture Series at Eastern Kentucky University hopes to broaden minds and expand intellectual curiosity. The theme of this year's series is What If, and it seeks to explore possibilities, alternatives, and ideas that excite both intellect and imagination while thinking creatively about the future in light of the past.
It is so unfathomable to me that we're not all going, this has got to stop.
What do you think is going to happen when there's not a permanent water supply for a 500 million people?
On this week's Eastern Standard, the Chautauqua Lecture Series. We'll have exclusive interviews with some of its guest speakers and the guy who organizes the program. This week is pre-recorded, therefore we won't be taking any calls during the show, but you're still welcome to write to us by email at wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. Post your comment to the WEKU Facebook page or send a tweet at WEKUEST and tell us what you thought of the program. It's time for Eastern Standard, right after the latest news from NPR. From the studios of WEKU on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University, this is Eastern Standard. Hello, I am John Hingsbergen. This year marks the 16th year of the Chautauqua Lecture Series on the Eastern Kentucky University campus. The theme for this year's series, What If? Inspiring intellectual curiosity and creative thinking about issues facing modern society. With us this lecture series and its development, or to discuss with us the series and its development, is Eric Liddell, coordinator of the Chautauqua Lecture Series at Eastern Kentucky. Professor Eric Liddell, Eric, talk about what else you do on campus. So the Chautauqua is actually just one of your responsibilities, is that correct?
Yes, it is. Thank you, John. I'm delighted to be here. And I am the coordinator of the Chautauqua Lecture Series, but I also am an honors faculty fellow, so I'm involved in teaching in the honors program. And I'm an associate professor of humanities, teaching comparative humanities in the Languages, Cultures, and Humanities Department.
Well, our listeners have heard at times we've done a couple of programs that focused on topics that were related to the Chautauqua Lecture Series. They've heard public service announcements on the air. And again, over these 16 years or so, listeners have heard about Chautauqua on the EKU campus. But I suspect that a very tiny percentage could tell us what is Chautauqua and what it's all about. And that's one of the reasons we have you here on this week's program. What is a Chautauqua and what are Chautauqua lectures?
Well, the Chautauqua movement began in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, coming out of an interest in adult education across America. And it really flourished into a kind of elaborate civic program of education across the country that involved lectures on various topics, like at the time, temperance and the work ethic, and these types of things that were in the public discourse of the day, but also including art and ballet and opera, all of the kinds of cultural enhancements to life that really make for a full and well-rounded life. And interestingly, you know, the Chautauqua movement, which in a certain sense is most identified with the Chautauqua Institution in upstate New York, mm-hmm. Which continues to this day and thrives to this day with summer camps and all kinds of programs all summer long, was called, I believe by Franklin Roosevelt, the most American of contributions to public life, because it does bring people together democratically to discuss ideas, to learn things throughout one's entire life, and to do so in a context of mutual respect and civic discourse. And we try to continue with that tradition here at EKU, but we have our own tradition as well that's, in a certain sense, now quite distinguished. Every year we select, or the Chautauqua Committee, which includes about 20 faculty members from across campus in various disciplines. We select a particular theme to invite distinguished, established scholars and activists and writers and poets and so on to come and talk to us about. And, you know, certain themes in the past have included evolution, love, war and peace, compassion, nature's humans, living with others. And this year's theme is What If?, a very open-ended question and invitation to people in their various disciplines to talk about what is on the cutting edge and what is on the frontier, on the horizon, And so that's what we've seen so far, and I know we have a great lineup for the rest of this year as well.
Sounds like a real open topic. So you,
it is.
How does one go about? How does you, or do you have a committee? Who makes these decisions about inviting people to come to campus and speak and the direction of the talks that they're going to give?
Yes, very fortunately for me, I do have the help of a committee, which includes faculty members from the library, music, criminal justice studies, history, basically the entire spectrum at EKU. And we get together in November or December and talk about what is of interest to us and what might be of interest to our students for the next year's theme. And we kind of brainstorm for a while and circle around all kinds of issues. And ultimately, out of that meeting comes or emerges the topic for the next year. And then we all consider that topic for a while, look for speakers in various disciplines that might fit into the schedule nicely. And I get lots of recommendations from my colleagues throughout the year to explore. And I basically then do some research, do some reading, look into the profile of various potential speakers. And if they are distinguished scholars who also know how to write for a public audience and who are great public speakers, then I will make an invitation and put together the schedule and try to make it truly interdisciplinary across the entire spectrum.
I want to ask you, Eric Liddell, to give me a bit summary of the folks who are on the schedule for the 2015-2016 Chautauqua Lecture Series. But I do want to let our listeners know what's going on. Normally, Eastern Standard is a live and interactive show on Thursday morning. But it is convenient for us in a number of ways for us to be recording this program. So we're not live on Thursday morning, although we are interested in hearing from your from you, your reactions, your comments about our conversation. You're welcome to write to us at any time, WEKU Eastern Standard at gmail.com. Send a tweet at WEKUEST. Our post for Eastern Standard will be up on the website as well as on Facebook, so you can also post messages or comments and carry on a discussion about what you hear during this conversation when you go to the Facebook page as well. Again, that email address, WEKUEasternstandard@gmail.com. It won't get on the air during this hour, but it could very well end up on the air, even in WEKU listener feedback. And later in our program, we're going to bring you some highlights of four of the speakers who have been on campus here at EKU during this year's series. But that's coming up in just a few minutes on this week's Eastern Standard. Eric Liddell, let's talk about, give me the 2-minute overview of the series, this What If series. Sounds like we could go off in a variety of different directions. And from my viewing of the schedule and my having met a number of the guests, the subject matter has gone off in a number of different directions.
Indeed. And that's one of the great features of this series. No matter what the topic is, if you come to any number of our lectures, you will be taken away to on a flight of the imagination and the intellect. So far this year, we've had speakers who have addressed power-based violence. That's how we began the year with Dorothy Edwards. We'll be hearing from her later on in this hour.
We're actually going to end our hour with Dorothy Edwards, so stay with us for that.
And, you know, she is the executive director of the Green Dot Program and began the year with a really energetic and inspiring lecture on how all of us can make a difference in identifying and intervening in situations where violence could ensue. Our next speaker was Helena Gashua. I think we'll also be hearing from her. And we brought her in conjunction with the Intelligence Studies Program to talk about Russia and Vladimir Putin, this very mysterious and strangely charismatic figure from Russia, to try to demystify him a little bit and to help our audience understand really, you know, what Russian culture today is about, how the ideology that Vladimir Putin projects is essential for us to understand as we engage Russia more and more going forward.
And again, we will be hearing from Elena in just a few minutes as well.
And, you know, that was those are both very, you might say, sociological kinds of topics. But we also had a couple hard scientists as well on the roster in the fall. Jack Gilbert from the University of Chicago, who is an expert on the microbiome. Again, I think we'll be hearing from him. He gave a fascinating talk on this frontier of biology, the ecosystem of bacteria and the microbes in our body that make a huge difference to our health. And he really, I think, gave a fascinating talk on that topic. And also Tony Barnosky, whom we'll also be hearing, who is one of the world's leading experts on climate change in the context of the history of the planet. So he is a paleobiologist, somebody who studies the fossil record and looks at patterns of climate change and extinction from the past and brings that information to bear on what's going on right now. So we were very lucky to have him on the eve of the Paris conference on climate change. And, you know, he was there as a kind of activist. And incidentally, you know, I had some continuing conversation with him via email. And he's very pleased with what came out of that conference. The 2% goal that was agreed upon was better than what people thought might be had going into that conference. And he's somebody who, again, is one of the world's leading scholars and gave a fantastic talk on what we need to do as a civilization, really, to save ourselves, save the planet, and prevent mass extinction.
Got to be a fascinating opportunity for you as an academic to interact with people of all of these various disciplines. Eric Liddell, coordinator of the Chautauqua Lecture Series on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University. And I will tell you, we've tried something new. And of course, I've been on campus for about a little more than 4 years now and have been aware of this Chautauqua series. This year, we really dove in and decided to partner. By way of full disclosure, to partner with the Chautauqua series to help promote the series and let listeners hear more of the content of that is being given during these lectures that are generally every couple of weeks or so throughout the academic
year. Pretty much. We have this year 16 lectures, so basically every other week. I should say that listeners who are interested to find out more about the Chautauqua series can find all of that on our website at chautauqua.eku.edu. If you haven't been out to a Chautauqua lecture in the past, please make every effort to come. There's free parking on campus after 4 p.m. for the lectures. We have meet and greet sessions in the library at 4:45 prior to the lectures, so you can get to meet the lecturers on a more familiar basis. And there is a kind of energy and special quality to a Chautauqua lecture when you're in the presence of some of these great thinkers and people who are on the cutting edge of their field and, you know, are doing us the honor of coming here to Richmond to speak to us, to talk to our students and faculty and community members. You know, we have people who come out from around the central Kentucky region and can attest to the fact that it really is a special experience to be there and to ask questions and to participate in the Chautauqua, which is a public lecture series, always free and open. Bring your friends, bring your neighbors.
We're going to hear from some of the folks who've already spoken during the Chautauqua series this year. We have some exciting announcements about some other things coming up, such as a live, again, not live, but a live on tape version of a program we're going to do talking about outer space and human colonization.
That's going to be fantastic.
It's going to be a really interesting program, and we hope that you're finding today's Eastern Standard to be an interesting program. Eric Liddell, coordinator of the Chautauqua Lecture Series on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University, with us for the rest of this hour. Send us your comments about the show. This is not a live show. It's a recorded program, but we're glad to hear from you at wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter. Please do so for updates about what's happening on Eastern Standard, and you can interact with us with your questions and your comments at wekuest. That email address again, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. We'll be right back. This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. Hello, I'm John Hingsbergen. And on this week's program, we're talking about the Chautauqua Lecture Series on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University. The coordinator of the series, Eric Liddell, is with us in the studio. A special edition of our program, not a live show on a Thursday morning, but we think that you'll find it a lively conversation and will continue to stay with us. We're going to hear from some of the folks who've spoken on campus already this year. This year's Chautauqua Lecture theme, What If? And Eric Liddell, why don't we just dive right in and talk about one of the speakers whom you mentioned a few minutes ago, Anthony Barnosky, talking about climate change. What was the focus of the talk that he gave earlier this year?
Well, the focus of the talk, which was called Dodging Extinction, Saving the Planet, Saving Ourselves, as I alluded to before, was really first a kind of history of climate change on the planet, various phases, right, in planetary history, during which the planet experienced accelerated warming or cooling, and an exploration of the effects that that had on species. And the hard analysis of this that Dr. Barnosky had done demonstrated that there's a certain background extinction rate that is, you might say, to be expected even in periods of accelerated heating or cooling. And then with that knowledge, we are then equipped to understand and try to appreciate and respond to, in a progressive way, what's going on the planet right now. We're all well aware that we're in a period of accelerated climate change, global warming. And so all of this is very pertinent information for everyone to get a grasp on. And he talked about very practical ways in which, most importantly, we can respond to the question of energy, power generation, to get off of fossil fuels entirely by 2050. It's not a question of just reducing, it's getting off of them.
Let's hear from Dr. Anthony Barnosky. Dodging Extinction, Saving the Planet, Saving Ourselves was the topic of his talk that he delivered during the Chautauqua Lecture Series at EKU on Thursday, November 5th.
Overall, the world is getting warmer. It's like Earth is getting a fever. And the problem with that is when you warm the atmosphere, you basically put the weather system on steroids. Storms get more frequent, more intense. You know, what used to be a wet place can become a dry place. What used to be a dry place can get even drier. What used to be the one in 5-year flood, or sorry, what used to be the one in 20-year flood becomes the one in 5-year flood. Hurricanes become much more intense. So the problem with that is civilization has evolved under a pretty stable climate system, and our existing structures, our way of life, our crop-producing systems are not equipped to handle the kinds of changes that already are underway.
We've heard, you know, I've heard tales of, for instance, there'd be coastal flooding, areas that are now coastlands going underwater, and the coast coming in, you know, much deeper than they have been. And that sounds like very disruptive, but it sounds like something that humans could adjust to. We say, okay, well, we just move a little further inland, and, you know, what was once a meadowland or farmland becomes beach property. Why is that a catastrophe as opposed to an inconvenience?
Well, it becomes a catastrophe if you start talking about places like, for example, Bangladesh, which has literally hundreds of millions of people that would be displaced inland. Displacing them inland means they have to move into another country. You know, we're already seeing a migration crisis coming out of Syria and into Europe. That's actually in part tied to droughts and food shortages that created the conditions for social unrest and the rise of the Islamic State. So it's, you know, we tend to think of these very direct climate impacts, a bad rainstorm or something, but what we really need to be worried about is connecting all the dots of how the climate system feeds into our overall lives. Another great example, if you want something to keep you awake at night, is we know that worldwide glaciers are melting at a pretty incredible rate, and this includes the mountain glaciers that supply the year-round water supply for over a billion people in South Asia. What do you think is going to happen when there's not a permanent water supply for a 500 million people in Pakistan, India, Bangladesh, and so on?
So we're talking about political repercussions. We're talking about unrest that could lead to conflict among nations.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, this is something that the national security community in the United States is very, very concerned about. As a matter of fact, it's been called the number one threat. Climate change has been called the number one threat to national security over the next decade or so.
But on the other side, there are those who poo-poo that and say that's I don't know what that would be, what they would say is it's a manufactured threat or it's a concern. It's not really all that important compared to ISIS or terrorism, compared to encroachment by political forces with an agenda of power, of taking over and controlling the lives of others. I mean, help make the connection
sure.
between the climate issues and how that is going to affect these political conflicts.
Yeah, well, the way it affects political conflicts is as long as things are going along okay in a particular part of the world, it's hard to stir up the energy to actually have social unrest. As soon as something happens to disrupt the equilibrium economically or in terms of food shortages or whatever, that's when things boil over into conflict. And, you know, a good example is the Arab Spring uprising. That was preceded by particularly bad droughts that decimated the crops in Egypt. That led to having to import a lot more food, which caused the economy to spiral out of control because the Egyptian government had to lay out so much money for food from outside. And eventually that percolated, that economic unrest and food shortages percolated into what we now know as the Arab Spring Uprising. You can paint the same sort of picture for what happened in Syria. So this is the way it comes together, with fragile parts of the world being set over the edge when you add one more push, in this case, the push being climate change.
Is the impact of this climate change evenly spread? Will it be felt everywhere evenly? Or will third world nations be more hit by the impact than, say, the U.S. and European nations?
Well, climate change will affect everywhere, but there's no doubt that the poorest people in the world will feel it a lot more than the richest nations. Interesting fact, the richest 1 billion people in the world, if you will, cause about 60% of the climate problem in terms of production of greenhouse gases. The poorest 3 billion in the world cause about 5% of the problem. So there's very much a disproportionate distribution of who's going to feel the effects more.
It's Dr. Anthony Barnosky. Dodging Extinction, Saving the Planet, Saving Ourselves was his Chautauqua lecture, the annual Bruce McLaren Distinguished Lecture on Thursday, November the 5th. We're talking about the Chautauqua Lecture Series on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University. And Eric Liddell, coordinator of the series, is with us in the studio. We're going to hear from some additional speakers, folks who've already spoken on campus this year, and a lot of exciting things still going on during the 2015-2016 academic year for the Chautauqua Lecture Series. I actually have had the great pleasure of getting a chance to meet a number of these folks who have come in to speak on campus. Jack Gilbert talking about bacteria.
Yeah, and talking about the microbiome, which, as you'll probably hear in the segment, is the idea of an ecosystem, a whole consortium of microbes living in our bodies and doing us good for the most part. This is real cutting edge stuff in biology. I'm very thankful to my biology colleague, Rebecca Weichel, for suggesting Dr. Gilbert for the series. You know, I mentioned earlier this, you know, that I get a lot of suggestions from my colleagues, and this was one of them. And when I explored Jack's profile, how he is involved in so many projects around the world, really, to examine the microbiome, how it relates to us as individual organisms, how it relates to us in institutions, in hospitals, and so on, in schools, but also how it relates to the natural world, I knew we had to get him. And you'll hear he's a really fascinating, dynamic figure who gave a great talk.
Microbes have been, since they were discovered, a source of horror to most people. We understood that they would cause disease in about the mid to late 19th century. So about for the last 150 years, we've been trying to wipe them out as much as possible. And what we're starting to understand is that the bacteria that exist within our bodies and exist within our environments, including hospitals, may actually be far more important and far more informative than we previously thought. So since the beginning, we've been developing antibiotics and antibacterial surfaces to try and kill them. Now we're starting to look at the potential for some of those good bacteria that exist in our bodies and in the environment to help prevent diseases and maybe even help people to recover more quickly. So, you know, if I put it in the what if scenario, my understanding is, what if we were able to harness bacteria living in our bodies and living in our environments to make us healthier, to make our environments healthier? It's almost an anathema to most people that we could use bacteria to make our bodies and our environments healthier. But we're starting to see that introducing certain organisms, certain bacterial species back into our body can help us to recover from asthma or maybe even alleviate sensitivities to food. So food allergies can become a thing of the past. We can prevent certain attributes such as autism conditions from developing. Many of these studies are in animals at the moment, but we're progressing those to humans. What if I can create a perfect hospital environment where you will never suffer from a surgical infection? You will never have to worry about getting a disease-causing organism penetrating your body and making you sick. Healthcare and associated infections could be eradicated using these kinds of techniques we're developing right now.
By raising this question, and I see the title for your talk, What If We Can Use Bacteria to Make Hospitals Healthier, what does that imply, or perhaps not merely imply, but openly state
Sure.
about hospitals? Are they dangerous places?
Well, you are significantly more likely to acquire a pathogen that makes you sick, a bacteria or a virus that causes illness when you're in a hospital. This is concerning, because most people think they go to a hospital to get better. But it also sort of makes sense if you consider that most people who go to hospital are under some kind of physiological stress. Their bodies aren't operating properly. That's why you're in hospital. And when your body isn't operating properly, it's more susceptible to disease, right? So if you take yourself and you put yourself in an environment where you are already susceptible and there are more pathogens around, you're more likely to acquire one. So what we're trying to do is understand how the 100 trillion bacterial cells in your body, how they become disrupted, and how a disruption of those bacteria make you more susceptible. And then we're trying to rebalance. It sounds very holistic, but it's actually incredibly scientifically detailed. But we're trying to rebalance the microbial ecosystem inside your body to make it more robust, to help it prevent you from getting infected by those nasty bugs.
When we do have an infection, a problem that our physician diagnoses as requiring an antibiotic, is that what we're doing? Is killing bacteria, killing the microbes that have caused this disease?
Yeah, I mean, the idea is that when you become infected with a particular pathogen, it becomes very abundant in your body. And it becomes abundant because it grows out of control. It takes over your immune system. Some of those bugs can use your immune system against the other bacteria living inside your body, kill them off, opening up real estate in the gut and in the lungs and on the skin that bacteria or virus can then take over. So they're like invaders, right? Mm. They wipe out the rest of the population so that they can take over and make you sick. And an antibiotic is supposed to be able to knock back that population of that particular organism enough so that we can reclaim that land, reclaim the invaded space. But what do we reclaim it with? What organisms do we add back in? Or how do we promote the body's own microbiome, the healthy bugs that live inside us, the 500 to 1,000 species of bacteria that colonize our body and make us well? How do we make sure that those ones become abundant again? And so all of our research is really focused around trying to understand how to get those healthy bugs to recolonize us after we've been forced to use one of these desperate measures.
We've heard over the recent years that we are overusing or overprescribing antibiotics and that eventually they're going to become ineffective and we're going to become subject to life-threatening illnesses that are not life-threatening today. What does that mean for the future of medicine and our health? Are we overusing antibiotics right now?
Absolutely, we are. I mean, antibiotics in general are a, well, let's just say they should be a last line of defense, but we use them inappropriately in many cases. A lot of this is based on our fear that if we don't prescribe an antibiotic and someone gets sick, then we will be responsible, potentially legally responsible for the events that unfold. So we as clinicians, we go in and we diagnose somebody and we say, well, okay, there's a percentage chance that you have a dangerous pathogen inside you. Let's give you an antibiotic to make to get rid of that or knock it back. But as you just pointed out, many of those organisms are becoming resistant. This is bacteria evolving in the face of a serious threat to their livelihood, right? Their livelihood is taking over your body and utilizing its resources to populate their numbers. And we are throwing a nuclear bomb at them in order to try and wipe them out. But it doesn't wipe out all of them. And the ones that survive then propagate and they have resistance against that nuclear bomb. And we are now trying to discover new ways to target those particular organisms. The future of medicine in this space will be a more judicious use of antibiotics, better prescription strategies at all levels, so we don't see overprescription and unnecessary prescriptions of these life-saving drugs, but also the development of new, more targeted strategies. Currently, I have a nuclear weapon. I dump it into your body and it kills the good bacteria along with the bad ones, right? Well, I want to make sure that maybe I only kill the bad ones. So I need to develop an assassin drug that goes in and targets only that bad bacteria and kills that one off, leaving all the good bacteria, all the innocent masses alone and healthy. If I can do that, and there are many groups around the US trying to develop those strategies, we'll be in a much better position to treat people.
Professor Jack Gilbert, what if we can use bacteria to make hospitals healthier? The invisible influence of the microbiome. That is a Chautauqua lecture that was given on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University in September, Thursday, September 24th. Eric Liddell is a coordinator of the Chautauqua series on the campus. And Eric is with us in the studio for the remainder of this week's Eastern Standard. We have two of our other guests who've been on campus that we'll be hearing from in the next few minutes. As well, some exciting things are still going on. Any preview? We've got 30 seconds right now, Eric, of what is going to happen next year, the 2016-2017?
Next year, how does that happen? Yes. Well, the committee has decided to explore the theme of order and chaos. That might be chaos and order, the interrelationship between those two things. And I already have some ideas for some speakers. I'm not at liberty to make any announcements at the present time, but it's going to be a really great series, a classic kind of theme, big question that cuts across all kinds of disciplines, politics and the cosmos.
All right. Perfect for the election season that will be underway. Order and chaos during the election season this fall. This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. We'll be right back in a few moments as we discuss the Chautauqua Lecture Series. This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. Eric Liddell, coordinator of the Chautauqua Lecture Series on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University, is our guest this week in a special edition of the program. The show not live on this Thursday morning, never live on Sunday evening at 6 o'clock, but we are still having a conversation that we hope that you're finding interesting. We're meeting some of the folks who have spoken so far during this year's Chautauqua Lecture Series on campus and learning a little bit about the program and the philosophy behind it, the reason behind the campus conducting this series. This is the 16th season, the 16th year.
Yes, it is. We're a very distinguished series now. Incidentally, interestingly, when I became the coordinator of the series, I received a citation of recognition from Rita Smart, our local legislator from this in the Commonwealth of Kentucky, congratulating not me so much as the series and commemorating the series as a great event that really adds something to public and civic discourse in the state of Kentucky. And I'm very proud to be here.
We're in the midst of your second season, I guess, yes. Coordinating the series. And it has a long history, distinguished series, a distinguished history of its presence on campus.
Indeed. And it was started by Bruce McLaren, whom you mentioned before. We have a distinguished lecture named after him, sort of the brainchild of Bruce, who was a biologist and philosopher of science. And he was at the helm for about 10 years and passed it off to Professor Ming Wen from the philosophy department here. And I've been on board since January of 2015.
the series this year titled What If. Eric Liddell, tell us about Helena Goshua and the subject matter of her talk.
Yeah, well, Helena Goshua is a professor of Slavic and East European Studies and Comparative Studies at Ohio State University, or I should say the Ohio State University. And she specializes in Russian visual culture, which includes art and graphic ideology and film, as well as novels and folklore and gender issues. And as somebody with a background steeped in the classics of Russian literature as well, from Pushkin and Lermontov to Dostoevsky and Tolstoy and so on, I knew that she would be somebody who could come and speak to us about culture and society in Russia post-glasnost, right, post-perestroika in this current age that we're living in, and also talk to us about what's going on with Vladimir Putin, a very curious, strange figure, I think, to most Americans who are somewhat mystified as to how he can be so popular in Russia with something like an 83% approval rating, projecting the kind of image that he does. Dr. Goshua put together a collection on Vladimir Putin as celebrity and cultural icon. And so we brought her here as part of our intelligence studies program and our languages, cultures, and humanities program's interest in developing a year of Russian studies. So we have courses and workshops and so on going on that topic. And she gave a great lecture on Putin and what his image means and how we as Americans can, I think, better understand him and his ideology.
She gave that lecture back on September 17th.
Today's Russia is bifurcated. It has two contrary imperatives. One is a move back to the Soviet past, and one is a move to the present but also the future. And while on the one hand, under Putin, Russia in the new century has been interested in going back to the Soviet past and recuperating a lot of the Soviet tendencies, at the same time, it has been advertising itself as a super new, glamorous, powerful 21st century empire. And a lot of this, I believe, has a lot to do with Putin's bitter resentment at the loss of empire with the breakdown of the Soviet Union. And his own personality is completely imbricated in this process, in as much as he himself used to be a member of the KGB, which certainly is a Soviet institution, which is maintained, and now it is the FSB. And he has, I think, in some ways, the typical mentality of a Soviet leader. At the same time, he is very interested in promoting Russia as a new, powerful, chic Eurasian power. And I think Eurasia here is very important because one of the things that distinguishes, one of the many things that distinguishes Russia from the rest of Europe, even Eastern Europe, is that it is located as sort of the outpost of Europe, but it is also partly Asian. So I think for Putin to present Russia as a unique, powerful, culturally rich country that is more than just a country is absolutely critical. And I think the tendency to resent the West for having imposed various paradigms on it during the Yeltsin years, has been surfacing, I think, throughout the 2000s, and culminated, of course, in the invasion and the capture, if you want, of Crimea, which originally, to be fair, it originally was Russian. Khrushchev in the 50s gave it to Ukraine, but it has been Ukrainian for the last 60 plus years. And if we were to go back in history and try to recapture what originally belonged to which country, I think the entire map of the world would be altered. For example, should England come to the US and take back the various colonies, so to speak, which comprise the United States? I think what Putin wants really is a new Russian empire, which would be analogous, not as big as, but analogous to the Soviet empire.
Many of us grew up under the Soviet Union and mm-hmm. the Cold War and the mm-hmm. tensions that existed between the U.S. and the Soviet mm-hmm. Union as the two major superpowers mm-hmm. In the world. And I guess without paying a lot of attention to what is occurring in Russia, many of us think that we have a more positive relationship with Russia than we had during that era. How do you feel about that? Is our relationship better today with Russia than it was with the Soviet Union?
I think it certainly is not as bad, though a lot of specialists, historians, political scientists have said that what we have is the onset of another Cold War. My sister and I wrote a book called Fade from Red, where we looked at mainstream American film and Russian film from the 1990s to the present. And what we discovered when we analyze a lot of films is that during the early 1990s, when Yeltsin was in power, Russia had this romance with America. And Russia really believed that America was going to help it solve its problems. And the 90s were totally chaotic under Yeltsin. And towards the end of the 90s, Russians were already becoming disillusioned with America. There was anti-American sentiment, which found reflection in Russian cinema. When Putin came to power, the first couple of years seemed to be not very decisive, but the longer Putin stayed in power, the more it became clear that there were things about the American way of being which Americans had tried to introduce in full form in Russia. They were not compatible with Putin's sense of what the country should be. Right now, what we have is a situation which seems to be a mild form of the Cold War. Mm-hmm. Now, Russians still travel, and they travel to the U.S. There are exchanges. American cinema is very popular in Russia, more popular than Russian cinema, in fact. Okay? So it's not as though there is a second Iron Curtain. But relations really are very low. The fact that Putin has anywhere from 83 to 87% support among the population.
Is that legitimate support? Of course, Americans look at that with skepticism.
I understand. Well, yes, I understand that. The center that I thought was very trustworthy until fairly recently was the Levada Center in Moscow, which reported various polls. And when I was skeptical about other centers' polls, it turned out that the Levada Center actually confirmed my skepticism. But the Levada Center now, as I understand it, I'm not 100% sure of this, under a new law, it is partly supported by the government. And that makes me very uneasy, very uneasy. So the Levada Center is reporting some things which are not very flattering to Putin. But if it says 87, it may not be 87, it may be 82. But I think Biden, it's the only one which has any credibility at all.
Putin is an elected president. Is that correct? Is he still in power because of the electoral process?
He was in power because of the electoral process was partly fixed. He didn't have to fix the elections. He would have won anyway. The problem is there is no viable candidate.
Professor Elena Goshua, who is from the Ohio State University, speaking on Contrary Imperatives, Culture and Society Under Putin, the Chautauqua Lecture on campus of Eastern Kentucky University on September 17th. On this week's Eastern Standard, we're talking about the Chautauqua Lecture Series, the themes, this year's theme, What If? Eric Liddell is coordinator of the series and leading us through some segments of some of the folks that we've had an opportunity to speak with already this year. Still some exciting things coming along. And great plans going forward. Eric, should we jump right into Jack Gilbert and tell our listeners about
Dorothy Edwards.
Dorothy Edwards, I apologize. I'm looking at so many materials here in front of me. As a matter of fact, Dorothy Edwards was the kickoff lecture this
year. But now you know what it's like being the Chautauqua Lecture Series coordinator. There's so many things, pieces of the puzzle to put together.
Kind of like programming a public radio station or something.
Yeah. But Dorothy Edwards is the executive director of the Green Dot, et cetera, research and training program, which deals with power-based violence, so sexual assault, rape, and these kinds of things, which, as we know, have unfortunately been all too present a phenomenon in our society, on college campuses, and so on. And they have been very influential and effective at dealing with this problem on campuses, in schools, in workplaces, and with the United States military. I believe they have some involvement with the United States federal government. And so we were very fortunate to have her on campus. EKU is a Green Dot institution where our faculty and staff can get trained in this every year.
When we're training bystanders, it's not just to notice the imminent, oh my God, this is about to happen, but to actually recognize the very earliest warning signs so we never get to a point where they're isolated.
How did you become interested in this concept? And I guess your focus is on sexual violence on campus. What caused you to take on this issue?
Well, there's two reasons. A very personal issue. Like many women my age, we know in Kentucky about 1 in 3 women experience some sort of interpersonal violence. So when I was in college, I experienced a sexual assault myself. Perhaps even more defining for me is when you can say numbers like 1 in 3, 1 in 4, 1 in 5 women experiencing violence as a part of their college education. It is so unfathomable to me that we're not all mobilized, that we're not all going, this has got to stop. And so when I just thought about the magnitude of the issue, the human cost of the issue, I felt compelled to go, this is something I could be a part of changing.
Are we talking about college campuses being a place where sexual violence is more prevalent than in the general society? Where do college campuses and the general society compare in this area?
There's some mixed research, but on sexual assault specifically, most research says the highest risk time for young women is specifically the 4 years they're on a college campus.
And that's why?
There's all sorts of reasons, and I don't think any singular one explains it. Whether it's because it's kind of the first time away from home and there's lots of freedom. We know lots of incidents involve alcohol, and so that goes into the mix. I think some of the pressure around, particularly with young men, about violence and sex and those kinds of things. So I think it's a whole mixture of things that contribute, and we don't have one single clear answer.
Do campuses choose to actively work with Green Dot to adopt the Green Dot program? How does that work?
Yeah. Campuses reach out to us and go, we're interested in this program. And they engage us. We come in and we do a 4-day training. And the folks we train are not just the directors of the prevention office or the violence intervention and prevention office. It's not just kind of the typical messengers. When we train, we want to train faculty and staff. We want to train, a chemistry professor. We want to train what we call unexpected messengers. Because if we can get 40 or 50 people on a college campus, professional staff that are trained, that's what begins to actually set the norm. Because if the only people that are talking about it are folks from the counseling center or folks from the prevention center, then folks go, oh yeah, of course they care about it. It's their job. But when all of these other, this cross-section of professionals on the campus are talking about it and involved in implementing, that's where it begins to say, this is really one of our values. So they bring us in for 4 days. We train those folks. We train them to implement hour-long programs and 6-hour-long programs that will then be taken by not only students, but will also be attended by other faculty and staff to learn what can you do in your particular sphere of influence to help change the norms on a college campus.
Dorothy Edwards, I guess she's an author as well as creator of the Green Dot Revolution and the Green Dot Program, and she was a Chautauqua Lecture speaker for the September 3rd Chautauqua lecture. And listeners also could have heard her, and you can still go back and hear the program in which we included Dorothy as we talked about sexual violence on our Eastern Standard program, a program that aired early in September. You'll find that on the website at weku.fm. Eric Liddell, coordinator of the Chautauqua lecture series on campus at Eastern Kentucky University, is with us. We have 2 minutes, Eric, for you to tell us more about some exciting things going on this year.
Absolutely. Thank you for the opportunity to be here and to share this. Our next official Chautauqua event is actually not a lecture, but our annual juried art exhibition, at which we have, I think it's, I'm checking my notes here, something like 52 works of art by 36 artists from 20 states exploring the theme, What If? And that exhibition will be in the Fred Parker Giles Art Gallery here on the EKU campus. Go to our webpage to find more information about that. It will run from this coming Monday, January 25th, until Friday, February 19th. And there will be a reception next Thursday, that's January 28th, from 5 to 7 p.m. with refreshments provided. There will be lots of people there, including myself, milling around, looking at the art, talking about the art and the theme, What If? We've got University of Arizona astrobiologist Chris Impey coming up as our first lecturer on February 4th, talking about what if we lived off Earth, our future in space.
We're going to have an exciting Eastern Standard program that week, as a matter of fact. We're going to record a program on that Wednesday morning, September, let's make that February 3rd, and at the Hummel Planetarium on the EKU campus. And listeners are invited to join us if you happen to be in Richmond or able to be in Richmond for that. 10 o'clock that morning, actually get there about 9 o'clock maybe, because we're going to have some exciting things going on over at the planetarium, and we're going to meet author Chris Impey. Eric Liddell, thank you so much. It's just a pleasure partnering with the Chautauqua series for this program and for opportunities to interview these guests and get to know some of these fabulous, fascinating topics and the fascinating people who are bringing them to the campus.
The pleasure's all mine. Thank you to you, John, and to WEKU.
Thanks to our producers. Noah Day put today's program together. We certainly want to thank Dorothy Edwards, Anthony Barnosky, Jack Gilbert, and Elena Goshiwa for their participation in Eastern Standard. Our program can be heard on Sunday evening at 6 o'clock, as well as on Thursdays at 11 o'clock, and our programs are available for podcasting and downloading from the website at weku.fm. Write to us at weku eastern standard at gmail.com. I'm John Hingsbergen. Thanks for tuning in.